Hi, everybody. Can you hear okay in the back? Is okay? Excellent. All right. It's funny. I hadn't thought about those days in Schwaben a long time. You'll all appreciate this. I had nothing to do, so I began watching television for language purposes. And then I would go downtown, and I couldn't understand anybody. And, of course, 2 years later, people explained to me that no one can understand them. So. I have my most cherished copy of Asterix and Obelix, which is actually written in Schwaben. And no one can understand it, of course. All right. As you see here, I have a picture of coal forest. And that's our topic today. Why would I be talking about energy when it's so political? Well, I had many colleagues ask me to, precisely for that reason. Often the conversation we have about this subject isn't very useful because we're focused on misunderstandings. And you can imagine I learned a lot. I learned a lot about engineering, geology, and a lot about politics working on this topic. I don't know what the title of this book will be in this country, but I hope it's something like Van Cola is Voorbij, because cola has a double meaning. My English language publishers changed the title because they said that peak oil is last year's news. So we don't want to talk about defeating. We want to talk about the power of the future. So we did that. But anyway, I'm going to talk to you today seriously about the future, okay? From the point of view of somebody who likes experiments and doesn't like a lot of politics messing them up. Now, let me ask you all a question. How long do you think the oil will last? Anybody want to guess? Actually, we can do it with hands. How many think the oil will last 500 years? Right. No. Okay. How about 100 years? How about 50 years? Yeah. Okay. Now, if we did this experiment with a business school, we'd get all sorts of crazy nuts, but the scientists usually say 50 or so. Now, that means all of us will be, well, all of you will be will be old, and I will be gone, as will your parents. So the thing we're talking about today crosses generations, and that's something important to keep in mind. All of us are struggling to make our living now, but all of us have other things to do in our lives, which we have children, and they have children, and so forth. And eventually, those people will have to face some terrible trouble. We don't know exactly when it will happen, but we know it's big trouble. Now, what I want to do in this lecture today is ask you to go beyond that. So we don't know the people of the future because they don't exist yet, but we do know they will be like us. And maybe you're not so sure about it, but I've had children now, and I know your children are just like you, including the parts you don't like. Okay? Your children are just like you, and their grandchildren are just like them. And so we've never met these people, but we know what they are thinking, and we know what they are saying, and we know what it will frighten them. And we know how worried they will be about their own children. So we know those things because they've been the same for thousands and thousands of years. So I want you today to imagine a time, maybe 2 centuries from now, 200 years, when it's all gone, and ask, what happened? Let's see. Okay. Oh, here it is. Yes. Okay, great. So I don't want to talk to you today not about what to do, because I don't know what to do. I want to talk today about what will happen. Some things we don't know will happen, but some things we do know. Okay? Now, so, what do you think, folks? Will there still be cities in this time? This is 6 generations away. All of you have been dead for 200 years. Well, not that long. 100 years. I will have been dead for 200 years. What do you think? We have cities? Okay. This particular picture, by the way, is from my favorite movie of all time, which is the famous Japanese anime, Akira. Anyway, that's... Now, let's see. Ah, yes, now. When we talk about the future, it's important to keep in mind the time scale of the past. Our contemporary, today's energy questions are 10 or 20 year questions, but the Earth is very, very old. Now, you all know this, but I'm going to remind you how old, okay? And I'm going to do it with rain. How much does it rain in 1 year? About this much. 1 meter. Average rainfall of the Earth is 1 meter. Now, here we have this amount of time when the coal burning has happened. This is 200 meters of rain. Size of a big dam. 200 meters over the whole world. Now, we go back to Moses. This is enough rain to fill up all the oceans. We go back to the Ice Age. This is enough rain to fill up all the oceans 4 times. We go back to the dinosaurs. This is enough rain to fill up the earth, fill up the oceans 30,000 times. So, the time scales of life and of processes in the earth are very, very long. Much, much longer than a human lifetime. Now, why this is important is because it helps us get our priorities straight. 1 human lifetime is not enough to destroy the earth. You can do damage, but you can't destroy the earth because the earth has lived too long. It's like invading Russia. It's easier to imagine than actually doing. But the energy crisis does come in a human lifetime. So we tend to mix up the questions of climate and energy as one thing, but they're actually not. Climate is a very grand thing on the scale of millions and millions of years. The energy problem is technical, and it's upon us right now. And so those of you in the audience here, when you're old people, will experience it. Very seriously, the first wave of the energy problem when the oil leaves us. So I, as a scientist, wish to keep them separate. The climate is more important, but the problem I have to deal with right now is energy. Now, this is to give you some idea of how big a problem we're talking about. This is, of course, the Rheinfall in Schaffhausen, and it's high. This is kind of a cheat because it's high. But I wish to compare this amount of water with the amount of oil we use, the world uses. And here is the calculation. Okay. For those of you who have hand calculators, you can check it. Okay. This is the official figure for oil usage, 85 million barrels. This is converting barrels to cubic meters, about a factor of 6. This is the flow of the average flow of the Rheinfall, and this is converting it to seconds, and it's almost half. Okay? So it's almost half. The amount of flow of oil is stupendously large, and we all know this, of course, and we also know that it won't get less. As India and China become big carbon users, this number will continue to grow. So this is why you can't just pass green laws and stop it. It's like passing a law to stop the Rheinfall. You can do something about it, but it takes much thinking and planning because it's a big problem, not a small problem. Now, how much oil is there? Nobody knows, except you do. And how do you know? This is a calculation I did using British Petroleum numbers. Actually, it comes out the same if you use any, but it's a simple calculation you can do. You take the estimates for how much oil there is in the ground and divide it by how fast you use it. And you get a time. And as most of you raised your hands at 50 years, of course, you're right on the button. That's 50 years. Now, in case you don't believe this number, there are two other ways to do it that I like. I think are better. One is you take the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia. Do the same calculation. Comes out a little bit longer, not here. Or you can take all the oil reserves of the Middle East. Same answer. Now, why this is important is because the Middle East reserves are much bigger than all the others. They are at least 10 times bigger and sometimes measured as 50 times bigger, depending on how you measure. And that means that the Middle East reserves, oil reserves, are the emergency supply. So this supply is what makes the oil price stable. People have surveyed it pretty carefully. And so, roughly speaking, you know how much oil there is in the Middle East. When it runs out, it doesn't mean the oil is gone, but it does mean that things get unstable. Because when there's a price problem, then the Saudis cannot turn on the oil tap and fix it. Okay? So that difficulty happens when it is somewhere between 50 and 70 years out. So I believe this number. The Wall Street Journal doesn't believe this number, and maybe the FOZ doesn't believe it. But I think it's right. I tell these guys, I've now shown you my calculations. Let's see your calculations. And they never show them. Now, how about the coal reserves? Very sensitive subject in this country because Germany has lots of coal. Not very good coal, okay, but lots of it. And so how much is there? Well, this you know a little better. The coal reserves in the world, we know where they are. So it's a little different from oil. You know where the big coal reserves are. The biggest ones are in the USA. China has huge supplies. Anyway, you add them up, and you get a longer number. Okay, maybe 150 to 200 years. So remember, I asked you to think about 200. That would be here. So I'm taking no chances. Already, you can see something interesting about the future that isn't political at all. And that is, there are going to be two events, not one. Okay? The first event happens here when the oil supplies get bad. Something economically will happen at that time. And then there'll be something else that happens here. Okay? So, at this point, we can still have a conversation about using the coal reserves. But when this comes, you can't have that conversation anymore because there isn't any left. When I'm calculating these times, I use the coal numbers because they're better numbers. You know better what the coal supply is and how fast it's used. Obviously, if you begin using it faster, this number goes down. Now, what about nuclear energy? It turns out that the uranium ore supplies in the world are pretty much known, estimates for those. And it's about the same. An amazing fact. We burn nuclear fuel very poorly nowadays, no breeding. And if the nuclear people keep doing that, then the nuclear energy runs out before the coal does. So the people who say that uranium is a fossil fuel are correct. There is no way out using nuclear energy except using breeding practices, which are even more dangerous than the light water reactor practices we use today. So remember I asked you at the beginning, what happens here? What is life for people here? Remember, industrial civilization is an invention. Every one of us here needs it to live. If all the machines in the world disappeared tomorrow, most of us would die. So this is a very serious thing, as you know. Now, this is a particularly sensitive subject, but let's talk about it anyway. Governments around the world all know that energy and GDP are the same thing. Countries that have large GDPs use lots of energy, and countries that use large energy have high GDPs. Here is a plot you typically get. Where did this data come from? The energy use comes mostly from BP, but it's checked, cross-checked against U.S. numbers and also EU numbers. So the energy use is a tight number. The other number, which is gross domestic product, is more uncertain. The numbers I used for this are CIA numbers. So they have an error bar on them about like this. Okay. Basically, the scatter in these numbers is mostly due to GDP. Also, the energy use per year has a multiplier in it that's different for different calculations. This is my multiplier for a barrel of oil. More conservative estimates put the USA down here. Instead of up there, they put it here. So we have 10% errors. This little cluster down here, it's obvious this is the EU. And I don't need to do this calculation. You can see with your eye If I average these, if I just add them vectorally, I'll get a number near the USA. Okay, it's obvious. It's the same line. China and Russia are not on this line. I don't know why not, okay? But I'll tell you what I suspect. This one particularly, I suspect they're lying about their income. I mean, it's very simple to get off of this curve. You just don't have tax people that know what the numbers are, right? There's a lot of black market in Russia. And knowing China, I'm certain that's the answer. Okay? The one point on here that's particularly important is Japan. You'll see that's about 10% off the line. Any of you that have been to Japan know that this must be real. Japan is very conservative with energy, and it's probably the best in the world. So what this tells you is what the best in the world is. Japan is the best in the world. The best you can get is 10% off this line. Okay? This graph is the reason that Kyoto isn't getting renewed. Now, of course, I don't know that. It might get renewed, but right now, there's just arguing. And the reason why is because all the leaders of the world secretly know that if they cut down on their carbon emissions, they will pay in GDP. And that, in turn, will get them unelected. So they don't want that. So they pretend to like Kyoto, but in fact, they will never vote for it. I mention this because people are despairing. You know, what are stupid governments? They don't listen to us, and there's a big problem, and so forth. Well, there's another problem that is equally sensitive that we don't talk about, which is maintaining the welfare of your people by the only way we know how. And this conflict is fundamental. Now, I mention this because when we're looking into the future, it isn't realistic to imagine those people 200 years from now living with no energy. That is not realistic. Why not? Because it's impossible. The best you can do is Japan. Okay? But getting way off that line is impossible. If you try, you will become Cameroon. Basically because GDP and carbon or fuel use joules are proportional. Let's see. Yes. Now, the slope of this line turns out to be an interesting number. Interesting and important number. So here's what it is. I did it for USA because it's one country and it was easier, but it comes out the same with EU. So I did it in dollars. The upper number is how much GDP you get per joule you spend. Remember, a joule, 100 joules a second is what your body produces when it's sitting in a chair. So the amount of GDP you get is 0.1 microdollars, 10 to the minus 7 dollars per joule. Now, there's another number that has that same unit, and that's the cost of electricity in dollars per joule. And I've worked it out here. This is my retail rate, the low end, my retail rate. And it comes out to be big, smaller. How much? But not a lot smaller, about 5 times smaller. Okay? So what you learn from this calculation is that the amount of GDP you get per joule is pretty universally about 5 times the cost of electricity locally. Okay? And no one except Japan has been able to change that number very much. In Japan, only did it by 10%. So that factor of 5 is what we're fighting against when we think about diminished energy use of the future. The data speak pretty clearly that no one in the world has figured out how to get GDP without joules. Now, I'd like to all ask you a question. Three questions. Three. And let's do it in a friendly sort of way. This is a friendly seminar. So, no more oil, all gone. Natural gas, all gone. The coal is all gone. Will people still drive cars? Show of hands, please. Who thinks people will still drive cars? Who thinks people will not still drive cars? I love this country. All right, now most everybody raised their, they will say everyone will drive cars. Now I know this. I remember the 70s. Everyone was shaming you. If you drive a car, you're bad. Naturally, everyone went out and bought bigger cars. Okay? Now remember, there's nothing in the ground to power them with now. And you all said that people will drive cars. Why? Any takers? There are lots of students here who raised their hand boldly and said, I think people will drive cars. Why did you say that? What? It's fun?
The sun.
The sun. Oh. Don't laugh too soon. Now, okay, so he says people will drive cars because of the sun. That's like saying that I will study physics because the wind is blowing. People may drive cars, and the sun will certainly be shining, but I don't myself think that people will drive cars because the sun is shining. You got it, yes.
Because I think the GDP also depends on how much cars we are able to power.
You've been talking to the US president too much. He says people will drive cars because you can't have GDP without cars. Any other takers? Yeah, back there. Yes.
There is a need of mobility and people have to move around.
Okay, so he says there's a need for mobility. Anybody else? Only here. In America, you don't use the train because there is no train. I took the train down here from Frankfurt, by the way. So. Anybody else? Yeah.
We're going to find other energy sources.
Same argument. See, I'm trying to get at the... So you say, he says, people will drive cars because there are other energy sources. And that's again like saying I'm going to study hard because the wind is blowing. Okay, yeah.
As a kind of personal freedom, perhaps, to get out of megacities.
He says personal freedom. People will personal freedom. Now we're getting to the end of the list. Yeah.
The people will drive past it, or they think the same way we do.
People.
They will just continue.
You know, it's funny. You people are red hot. You're just red hot, but you're not quite. Yes. Okay. Wait, we're getting to the freedom and mobile part. And now, for some reason, this audience is very shy, and it doesn't want to say, maybe you're going to say it.
Just as you understood it, because it's fun.
They want them. They just want them. Now, you think this is a joke, but you go to parts of the world where people don't have cars. And, of course, the value of having a car goes way up. I remember in China, when China first had, the car boom began in China, and practically nobody had cars, so the people who did have them were so high up. Everyone worshipped them, and they wanted to borrow the car. They would pay extra money. If you have daughters and you want a good husband for the daughter, if you've got a car, you're in. Or if you want to marry good, you know, you drive up in a big black car and dad invites you right in. The point is, in places that aren't industrialized, cars are an enormous status symbol, precisely because you can't have them. Okay? And so everybody in that part of the world, those parts of the world that are carless, they just dream about having a car all day. Once I was in Beijing, and we were in a traffic jam, I had my son with me, and there was right next to us people on bicycles. One of them had a Mao suit, one of the last in China. And I thought I'd teach this kid a lesson. I said, okay, see that guy out there? I said, what's he thinking? Nat answered instantly. He says, he's thinking, I wish I had a car. And I'll tell you, folks, I was a very proud father when he said that, because, of course, that is exactly what he was thinking. And so my son made a giant step toward understanding the world. Now, that means that there is an economic factor that is really important. Now, we have needs hitting up against physical limits. What this simple calculation tells you is that people will pay anything to have freedom and mobility. We know this from examples around the world. That, in turn, will change the economics of fuels when the time comes that there is no more in the ground. Something is likely to happen that has never happened before in history, which is the price of freedom and mobility goes crazy, whereupon something is likely to happen because the profits to be made cannot be imagined. So people drive cars. Good. Now, next question. This is a little harder. Will people fly in airplanes? Remember, there's no more fuel, and the oil wells are dry, the coal mines are empty, and now will there be airplanes? So let's have show hands. Who thinks there will be airplanes in this distant time? A little harder. Who thinks there will not be airplanes in this distant time? Okay? Now, anybody want to wade into this one? No, those of you who voted yes on the airplane, why? Why'd you vote yes? Yeah. He's caught on to what the answer that I want, unfortunately. I'm not honestly fishing for answers. I want to know what you think. This one is harder. And when I've asked this question around the world, people have to think harder about this one. Now, this is important because the economics of airplanes is different from the economics of cars. Most people eventually decide, yes, there will be air travel, although there won't be as much. That's what most people say, because it will be expensive. But the people with lots of money will still like the speed and convenience of air travel and will want it. So there'll be some, most people think there'll be some air travel. Now, I don't myself know, of course. The people who voted no probably are worried about pollution and where's the fuel going to come from and so forth. Well, let's talk about that now. Suppose we imagine in this time in the future, there are some airplanes. What fuels them? Any ideas there? What?
Hydrogen.
Man, maybe you're going to fly in a hydrogen-powered airplane. I'm not, you know. I'll go to your funeral. What you say is true. You might have hydrogen in the planes. And what?
Batteries.
Batteries. He says batteries. Yes. So what?
Biofuels.
What kind of biofuels? Fish tanks in the airplane. That's going to happen. So batteries. We got batteries. We got, yeah.
Just be ballistic.
There he goes! Oh, bad landing. try again. Shut him off. Okay. Now, this is a time where we have to get serious now, because there is some physics to know here, which you study physics and chemistry, you know. There is a fundamental limit on how much energy you can put in a small space. And ordinary jet fuel is the best it can ever be. It's not an accident that we use kerosene for jet fuel. It has the greatest energy per cubic meter of all things. Moreover, it's easy to prove with quantum mechanics that it is the fundamental limit. There never will be anything better than that. It's impossible. It's physically impossible. This is something you don't have to worry about centuries of research, what those scientists are going to think of, because those scientists will not change the laws of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics says jet fuel is best. Now, what that means is we're not going to have battery-powered airplanes, because the batteries are too heavy, right? The plane is running, it just lifts off. Oh, time to land again. Okay. And as we said, hydrogen is not so different from jet fuel, actually, conceptually. But hydrogen is dangerous. And hydrogen does explode, and I'm not kidding. I think there's a problem with it. More to the point, the fuels for these airplanes have to be made. You see? They have to be made. And if you're making the fuel, you might as well make jet fuel. The energy that you need is the same, but jet fuel is safer and more compact and just a better fuel than hydrogen is. And the energy cost is exactly the same. So, you know, might as well make jet fuel. Said more precisely, you know for sure that there will be carbon-based fuels in the future, because they are the best fuels that ever can be. And when the petroleum runs out, people will have to make them. Now, that's something you have to check for yourself, but if you're interested in it, just look into it and you'll see what I say is true. We can predict with confidence that the evil oil industries will never disappear. And the reason is, even when the petroleum disappears, the evil oil companies will still exist, because somebody has to make the fuels, because people want them. That means the carbon-free future that a lot of people imagine simply cannot be, if you imagine also that there's air travel. Now, of course, predicting the future is always risky, but this is something I'm happy to take any bet you like, even though I'll be completely dead when the bet is due. I'm sure that there is no way to fly airplanes except with fuels made of carbon. Now, the last question. No more natural gas from Russia. Gone. No more brown cola. No more anything. People turn the light switch on. Maybe the lights come on, or they don't come on. What do you think? In this future time, will the lights come on? Who says yes? Who says no? You say no, okay? They'll get you. You know what'll happen if you know your lights won't come on and theirs will. All right, folks, most audiences do the same. They say the lights will come on. Now remember, here, these lights are coal. This is coal energy you're seeing here. Where I live, it's all natural gas. There's a little bit of nuclear energy in here, but not much. And soon there will be less. And it will be replaced by natural gas from the Urals. So the light you're seeing is fossil light. And when the fossil fuels come, there's a problem of where it comes from. Okay? Now, you people said the lights will come on. I want to know why. Why do you think this? Why, if you think the lights will... Yes, ma'am. You know, that, okay, so she says it'll come on because of renewable energy. So you're saying the lights will come on because there is renewable energy. Okay, anybody else? Yeah.
Tidal power.
By
the way? Tidal power.
Tidal power. He says the lights will come on because of the tides.
Tidal, with the water.
Yeah, I know. Oceans do this, yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
Living and working without light is impossible.
Okay, he says because you can't live without it. Just like you can't live without your car, perhaps. Anybody else?
Not that much.
Now, this is interesting. So I got technical answers back. You're not all telling the truth. Someone is not telling the truth here. So I'll put the words in your mouth for you. Okay. Turns out my state I live in went through recently a case when the lights didn't come on. Okay? It happened. And I think I've got a picture of this. No. Where's my picture? There's my picture. Okay. I remember this vividly because it happened during my time. The regulations of electricity got damaged, and the lights didn't come on for a year. There was a problem with the lights coming on. And when this occurred, there was a political problem like you can't believe. I can't think of anything in this country that's happened in my lifetime like this. The government turned upside down. Suddenly there was no money. Everyone was blaming everyone else. No one knew what had happened, and every single politician lost his job. And as you know, we got the Terminator for governor, which was fun. Actually, he was a very good governor. But the point is, he came into power as a result of the lights going off. Now, this you may not have noticed this, but every single government official around the world noticed this. And they thought, if the lights go off, I'm dead. Now, most of electricity generation and delivery is highly political, highly regulated in most countries. So that means there's a political problem with electricity. If electricity goes off, you just bring down the government and you keep doing it until the lights come on. Okay? So you were all thinking that, but you didn't say it. So I said it for you. It's yes, the lights will probably come on. And the reason is because there's a political push. Now, let me remind you all now. We've answered these three questions about energy without talking about technology at all. Okay? Without talking about technology at all. We've simply said what people will want or what the political scene will be. Which is to say, we've described the economic forces underneath. And that is the way most people actually think about this problem when you push them. That there are things coming that are different from, they're economically different from what we know now. And those things will turn people's motivations around. And probably what will happen is many little alternative energy things will pop out in ways you can't really imagine right now, because whoever invents one will be so rich that if they want to commit suicide, they can climb up on their money and jump off. Okay? So this is the beginning of, I think, my own thinking through the technical future. You see, what you've all said with your votes is, as it turns out, agrees with me as well, and most people I know. Namely, it will come out all right. Okay? It will come out all right because the prices of things will go crazy And the response, people's response to those repricings will be new things that you haven't imagined yet. Now, so that's helpful. You see, when we start thinking about this problem, we normally think about how first, you know, how to solve it. But here I've reversed things. I said, first, let's imagine if there's a solution. And then we decide that first. And then if there is, then we go back and we think about details. Now, let's talk about this a minute. I mentioned carbon. So you can figure out some things. There will be a carbon industry. Why? Well, because the carbon atoms fix the design problems of the hydrogen. Now, in this future time, there isn't any more carbon in the ground because it's all in the air. That means to make carbon things, you have to pull it out of the air. If you're not putting more carbon in the air, carbon is pretty good. Okay? And the problem is increasing it. But you see, if it's all gone, then you're not increasing it. And then you see carbon switches sign. You see, carbon is very evil now. But suppose you burn up all the coal, then carbon is not evil anymore because the greenhouse effect doesn't change. And then you find carbon has all these neat problems. And then you look and you see all the technologies that you have. Okay? You've got batteries and you've got these flywheels and all these. And then you discover every single one of them is dangerous. Every single one. Batteries are a terrible environmental pollutant because the metals in them really are poisonous. And the more clever is your battery, the worse it gets. It's very ironic that when you make waste technologically, the only kind of waste that is not poisonous is CO2. So that's something you can predict. That you know in this time that the meaning of carbon dioxide will switch. Right now, it's the devil. But in this future time, carbon dioxide won't be bad. It'll be the only waste product of civilization that is not poisonous. And that's important. And then, as I said, the carbon in the fuels fixes the design problems of the hydrogen. So when you put the carbon in there, it's not dangerous. Now, let's assume that people decide to do this. They're going to make ways to store energy. Right now, you get it out of the ground. But in this future time, you have to store it somewhere. And this is making a fuel is a very good way to store it because it's safe. I think we can imagine reasonably in this time that there will be artificial fuel. Now let's ask, where is the carbon going to come from? There's no more coal left, no more natural gas left. All of you said people are going to be driving cars. All of you said people are going to be flying in airplanes. And all of you said the lights will come on. You need some carbon. Where is it going to come from?
Rocks.
I hear rocks. Okay. So one guy says rocks. Anybody else? So I've got plants here. Anybody else? It's funny. We're all used to thinking of carbon as bad. It's hard to imagine thinking the opposite way. Where is it going to come from? Well, let me ask the question a little more provocatively. If you take it out of rocks, which you can do, and lots of energy is involved, okay? If you take it out of the air, lots of energy is involved. So you're competing with plants. Huh? You make this new technology that people will need 200 years from now. Who's going to win, the plants or the scientists? Okay, let's have a vote. Okay? Scientists. Okay? Who thinks the plants are going to win? How interesting. That comes out the same worldwide also. And I think it's simply common sense. You know, the plants are very clever. And the problem is they've been in this business for 3 billion years. And they really know what they are doing. And so there are scientists who have companies that think they're going to do better than the plants. But I think they're lying. In fact, it's amusing. In the States right now, there's a lot of biofuel activity due to a particular Air Force contract. Air Force, the Congress told the Air Force to get green jet fuel. So they said, okay, there is no such thing. So companies popped up, and the one that won the bid, the winner is a company in San Francisco that makes the jet fuel from algae grown in bags in a warehouse in the dark. Algae in the dark. I'm not making this up. They have these green plants, and they're making sure that no sunlight ever gets on these plants. And instead, they feed the plants sugar made from what? Well, corn, of course. Okay. Now, why? Well, because the government said, give us green jet fuel. And they found that the algae make better jet fuel if you grow them in the dark. Well, of course, this is not funny. Green plants growing in the dark to make technology is not funny. That is a failure of technical thinking that coming about with, it's just a failure of the system. It's ridiculous. Now, the point is that you can, just by common sense, figure out that in this future time, there will be a carbon problem as much as an energy problem, and maybe even worse, because energy can come from other places like the sun. But the carbon is all locked up in the rocks and in the air, and it takes energy to get it out. And who's good at getting it out is plants. So you can, I think, predict with some confidence that there will be a new kind of agriculture in existence at that time, different from what you have today, that supplies carbon for the world in parallel with the agriculture that makes food. By the way, what's my time? What? How much do I have?
Just
go on. Well, he won't tell me how much time I have. Now, you all know who this is, but I'll remind you: it's Franz Fischer, who invented the transition metal catalysis of what we now call synthesis gas into long chain fuels like you use in your car. This technology actually comes from the 20s. It was originally a coal technology. The Nazi government tried hard to make petroleum with this and its brother technology. Didn't quite succeed because it was very expensive. They made a lot of fuel, but it wasn't enough. At any rate, these events that happened in the beginning of the 20th century tell you that the technology for making the synthetic fuel already exists. This is not a science fiction exercise. You just look it up in books. And I make a little joke here, man of the 21st century. My guess is that this is actually going to happen. That as we move into the end of oil, that this technology will become one of the most important things in the world because it will allow you to keep your cars even though the oil is running out. Not only that, but the plants in question are already built. This particular one is in Malaysia. It's in a place called Bintulu in Malaysia. It's Royal Dutch Shell that built it. There's another one that's much bigger. Do I have a picture of it? No, I don't. There's a huge one that just got demonstrated. It's in Qatar. It's a $20 billion US dollar plant built in Qatar designed to convert natural gas into long chain hydrocarbons by the Fischer-Tropsch process. So we don't need to worry about future research agendas to know that the fuel can be supplied. The technologies are actually quite old, and they're deployed in the field already very quietly, ready to go in when things get tough with the oil supplies. Now, we talked about this already. This is something you can predict, that there's a coming issue of industrial agriculture, and there's an issue of competing with fuel supplies that will come about. This is another talk. The one sentence summary of the other talk is that this agriculture, when it comes to pass, will be based on saltwater. The reason is that's the obvious way to avoid competition with fuel, with food supplies. I think you can make this prediction with some confidence, because there will be a need for industrial carbon in this future time, and there will also be a need for food. And it's perfectly possible to make plants that grow like crazy in salt water. In fact, most algae do this. But it is not generally possible to make food plants that grow well in salt water. And so this is the solution I'm fairly sure that will work out. Now, we talked about him. Okay, so when coal is gone, this is what we're looking at. Absent a very serious change in the world governance, when I'm dead and all of you are old, there's a crisis that involves a price crossing of oil and coal prices, joules, and then there's a second one that comes much later that is much more severe, when the coal is gone. Now, let's mention one more thing, and then I want to stop for questions, because I think I've talked enough. This is obviously hypersensitive right now, because Mrs. Merkel just put a cap on the nuclear plants. Now, they're struggling with this problem in East Asia right now. We don't yet know how it will come out. What you do, however, know is that this technology won't disappear. And that means it'll be in the background doing something when the crises come. So right now, there's no crisis. We can burn more natural gas and let the nuclear plants glow. No problem. But things will be different when the fossil fuels begin to go and people get desperate for power. So we'll have to wait until this plays out. But now the food for thought here is that this technology that we don't like may very well put a price ceiling on the cost of electricity. So when people are struggling to find alternatives, the only way they will be able to stop nuclear power is to invent something else that's cheaper. Okay? And that in turn means, I think, that you can predict the electricity price with some certainty through this terrible time. It will probably be not too different than it is today. Okay? So regardless of how you feel about nuclear power, it's going to have an effect in this future time, no matter what. Now, I have this terrible feeling that I'm running out of time. So running out of attention span. So we'll finish now. This is, of course, a picture of a very famous solar energy plant in Spain, which is Andesol 1. I happen to love this plant to death because these people publish their specs, and the energy, the numbers are wonderful. They're right on the money. And moreover, you may wish to know, this particular company is leading the fight at the moment to solarize the Mojave Desert near Los Angeles. It's underway building the world's biggest solar plant, which is 1 billion watts. And I personally think this particular episode of alternate energy is unfolding right before our eyes. Perhaps in the Sahara, I don't know. but near my hometown in California, definitely. And it's just an interesting note on history that that a German company is at the forefront of this particular event. All right, so what's the world like when coal is gone? Well, I don't know. But I think for discussion purposes, we've covered what I wanted today. I think when we begin talking about this, we have to imagine a world not so different from the one we inhabit now, except with slightly different prices. And with people like us living the way we do now, and it's okay. It comes out okay. All right, everybody. Thank you for staying, for listening to me drone upon, and thanks a million.